Welcome to another deep dive. Today, we're embarking on a journey into a fascinating urban transformation. It's a project that promises a vibrant future, but as you'll discover, it has this surprisingly deep and, well, controversial past. You sent us some incredible sources about the redesign of the Breddegarten in Witten, Germany.
Yeah, everything from official city plans, historical accounts, and even some charming yet pre-stark children's drawings.
Right. And our mission today is really to sift through all these layers. We want to uncover not just what's happening now in this one specific urban space, but why it's happening. You know, what does the history of this particular spot tell us about city planning, about community, and maybe even some uncomfortable truths that resonate far beyond Witten? Okay, so let's jump right in then. We're looking at a community green space that's getting a massive facelift. The aim is to be a lively urban open space. But as we start to peel back the layers, you'll find its story is way more complex than just, you know, fresh turf or new swings. Let's begin with the present. What exactly is the city of Witten trying to achieve with this redesign of the Breddegarten? What's the vision for this space now?
Well, right now, the area is still a bit wüst. That's a German word. It means kind of desolate or wild.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, ambitious plans are definitely underway. The city's stated goal is to transform it into a truly lively urban open space, right at the heart of Witten. And importantly, one designed with direct citizen input, or so they say. Specifically, the plans include a much larger and modernized children's play area. And beyond just play, they're introducing these community spaces for creative and education-oriented offers, trying to make it a hub of activity.
And this redesign isn't just a local thing, is it? I understand it's part of a larger state-level program.
That's exactly right. This isn't just Witten acting alone. It's funded by state money through the Lebendigzentren, which translates to Living Centers program. It's a broader initiative, really, aiming to revitalize urban cores across the region. They also envision a communal garden project within the Breddegarten and a redesign of the Bürgerachs, the citizen access. Mm. That's a pedestrian path connecting the train station to Breitstrasse. The whole thing, they're aiming for completion by 2027.
Okay. Now, you noted something intriguing about the official descriptions of these plans. You called them full of plastic words. Could you unpack that a bit? What did you mean?
Yeah, it's something that really stands out when you read the planning documents. It's the frequent use of these vague terms like urban, living world, garden, laboratory, creative project. You see them everywhere. These are what I call hollow words. They're almost like Lego bricks. You know, you can stack them up and they sound meaningful. They imply meaning, but often they're pretty contentless. It makes it genuinely hard to pin down the specific outcomes or, well, the actual intentions. And the key insight here, I think, is how this seemingly progressive language can actually obscure the concrete plans. It makes accountability difficult and potentially allows underlying issues to persist unnoticed. It's a pretty common issue in city planning language, actually.
Hmm. That's a really valuable insight, how language shapes our understanding or maybe misunderstanding of urban development. Okay, let's pivot now to the historical backdrop, because this current revamp is deeply tied to something significant that happened, what, about 45 years ago? What did you uncover about that connection?
Right, this takes us directly to a crucial historical context, the inner city renovations of the 1970s. Some critical voices back then actually called this period the second destruction of Germany.
Mm.
The argument was that after World War II, cities, particularly in West Germany, were rebuilt almost exclusively around the needs of car traffic. Just roads, parking, more roads. And this often meant tearing down much of what the Allied bombings had actually left standing, prioritizing new infrastructure over historical structures, mm-hmm. effectively erasing parts of the city's past.
So in many places, what the war didn't destroy, the post-war planners kind of finished the job. You mentioned a specific example in Witten, a little castle that was demolished.
Indeed. There was this beautiful, well-preserved building at Steinstrasse 1. It used to house a furniture store, and it was just flattened during this period. Locals apparently called it a proper little Schlüssen, like a small castle, just removed to make way for this new car-centric vision of the city.
So if that was the general trend, demolishing old structures for new roads, how did Witten end up with a garden, the Breddegarten, in the middle of all this car-centric redevelopment? That seems quite counter to the logic of the time, doesn't it?
Well, Witten, in a sense, had luck and misfortune, you could say. The wave of urban demolition, it was actually stopped here, partly due to unexpected citizen action, specifically house occupations, like the one at Bahnhofstrasse 54. This activism, this pushback, it finally sparked public and often quite controversial discussions about these inner city renovation plans that had largely been accepted without much question before. It really raises an important question for us today, too. How do citizen movements, even seemingly small ones, actually impact and sometimes alter the course of these massive urban development projects?
That's a powerful point about local activism making a real difference. And wasn't there a key figure involved in halting some of that demolition and pushing for a green space? Someone who kind of read the room, recognized the shifting public mood?
Absolutely. The then city building councillor, a man named Jochen Bultmann, he seems to have had a very fine sense for the changing discussions and the desires of the citizenry. He championed the idea of this Grünenlot Breddegarten. And the name Bredde itself, it comes from the historical term for the large, wide field and meadow area that used to be here, next to the Breddeschule and Breddestrasse. So the Breddegarten, as we've known it for the last few decades, was effectively born around 1975, so exactly 50 years ago now, as a direct result of these citizen interventions. And yeah, a more enlightened planning approach, at least for a time.
Right. So this green space literally grew out of the rubble, both literally and maybe figuratively, from these urban renovations. Okay, let's rewind even further. What was the specific plot of land like before it became the Breddegarten in the 70s? What's its even earlier history?
Yeah, I looked at some old aerial photographs, and they really tell a vivid story. Up to the 1950s, this area, and it's roughly the size of Humboldtplatz, maybe 4,000 square meters. Mm. It was just a jumble of buildings, not neatly organized at all, but sort of higgledy-piggledy, as if someone had just scattered them there. There were also large trees, apparently, including a huge, beautiful lime tree. However, after 1945, you know, with 80% of Witten's inner city destroyed by bombings, this particular plot became just a desolate Trümmergrundstück, a rubble plot. And it wasn't a pleasant place at all. Sources say it was openly used as a dog toilet, a playground for rats, and frankly, just a garbage dump.
Wow, far from a peaceful green space. Sounds like a truly neglected, almost dangerous corner of the city back then. You even found an anecdote about items from an eviction being just unceremoniously dumped there?
Indeed. There's an account from 1981 when a squatted house nearby was cleared out. The residents' belongings, refrigerators, furniture, you name it, were simply thrown onto this plot, just dumped. Local residents described it as an uncontrolled social space. Alcoholics often gathered there, smashing bottles in the bushes, which made it even more hazardous. One resident even called it a dead place.
Grim. Yet, even amidst all that chaos and neglect, children still found a way to play there. They often do, don't they? Finding joy and imagination, even in the toughest environments.
Yes, they absolutely did, which is quite remarkable when you think about it. Despite the dangers, broken glass, piles of trash kids built makeshift bridges over huge puddles using wood scraps.
Yeah.
They sped through on BMX bikes, creating a lot of noise. An early 1980s resident captured the soundscape perfectly. She described a cordon of sounds, trains, factory announcements, car horns, kids from the nearby Breddeschule, youth from the Hosterjugend next door. It was, in her words, the center of the noise in the area.
And this brings us to a particularly, well, heartwarming, but also stark detail in your research. The direct involvement of children in actually shaping the future of this space. It's not every day you hear about kids directly influencing city planning like that.
No, it's truly remarkable. And what's clear here is just how crucial children's voices were in driving change. Before the Breddegarten was created, there was a small, regular playground nearby, maybe 100 square meters. But the local newspaper, the Ruhr Nachrichten, they called it a Drecksack, basically a dirty corner. And apparently, it served as little more than a better dog toilet. Clearly inadequate and pretty unpleasant.
Yeah, that sounds pretty grim for a dedicated play area. Not exactly inviting for kids.
Not at all. And this led to an extraordinary intervention in 1979. Class 3B at the Breddeschule got directly involved. These children wrote this beautifully designed booklet. It had drawings, descriptions, everything. And they were demanding better play facilities from the city. This booklet, it's still preserved in the city archive today. It's quite moving to see their direct appeal, their, you know, clear, articulate grievances.
Wow. What kind of things did the children write in their booklet? What were their specific complaints or their wishes for a better playground?
Well, one child wrote that the garbage collectors would sweep leaves onto the playground and then just leave them there. And also that vagrants sleeping on benches would smash their beer bottles, forcing the children to, quote, play between dirt and shards. It paints a very clear and disturbing picture of just unacceptable conditions. This powerful testimony, along with other complaints from residents about a general lack of recreational spaces, really prompted the city's response. The city planning department clearly saw the redesign, the creation of the Breda Garden, as a unique opportunity to finally create a child-friendly and safe playground, one of central importance for the inner city. So the children's activism, it really highlighted a critical need that the city eventually tried to address. This led directly to the original Breda Garden plans.
Right, so the city developed these plans in response to this clear need expressed by residents and, crucially, by the children themselves. So what did that initial Breda Garden design look like back when it was first envisioned around 1980?
Okay, so the plans presented in spring 1980, after a public meeting, were quite detailed. They envisioned a larger, brighter, and definitely cleaner children's playground with lots of play equipment situated between the Breda Schwul and the Haus der Jugend. And crucially, the main Breda Garden area itself would have 16 small allotment-styled gardens for surrounding tenants to rent. Plus, get this, a school garden specifically for the Breda Schwul.
A school garden? That's a detail I certainly haven't heard mentioned in relation to the current plans. It sounds like a fantastic, really integrated idea back then.
Neither had I, until I dug it out of the official files. Fascinating. Additionally, a smaller kids' play area was planned within the main garden section, with swings and hammocks and seating for adults nearby. And the plan also had this sort of didactic purpose. It wasn't just for lingering, but the idea was to make the children's walk to school or into the city playful and varied, integrate play into the journey.
Okay, but here's where it gets really interesting and quite frankly disturbing. You mentioned that the seemingly positive plans were highly controversial, leading to a lawsuit from a powerful local institution. Who was it, and what on earth were their objections?
Yeah, this is where the story takes a turn. The plans faced massive objections, particularly from the Booker Stiftung. That's a foundation running a nearby retirement home. They actually sued the city to try and stop the development entirely. Their primary concerns, at least initially stated, were about noise. They feared the noise from children playing would disturb their elderly residents. They also complained about things like balls landing on their property and teenagers on mopeds playing loud music nearby. Sort of standard complaints, maybe. But then, a truly disturbing objection emerged in their official complaint to the city. The Booker Stiftung claimed, and this is a quote, that the share of Gastarbeiter Kinder, guest worker children, had risen imminently, leading to communication difficulties.
Wait, what? They actually put that in writing, in an official complaint. That's just blatant racism, isn't it? An outright objection based on the children's background?
Yeah.
Exactly. It was racismus pur, as the source I found put it. Pure racism. The city, to their credit perhaps, tried to compromise. They suggested moving the playground further away or introducing quiet times. And the local CDU political party, the conservatives, even supported the Stiftung. They advocated for the land to be sold off for profitable housing instead of being used as a community green space. It really highlights this long-standing difficult conflict in city planning. How do you balance the perceived needs of the elderly with those of children and youth, and in this case, tragically, with this overt layer of prejudice just laid bare?
That racist remark from the Booker Stiftung is just jarring. It makes you wonder about them. It made you dig into their history, didn't it? What did you find about the origins of this foundation, given the specific objection to Gastarbeiter Kinder?
Yes, it seemed important to understand where they were coming from. And what's truly revealing here are the Stiftung's origins and how they perhaps connect to this later prejudice. Their own website states the Booker couple founded a clothing house back in 1912. It expanded significantly in 1938, combining two buildings at Bahnhofstrasse 17 and 19 into the big Booker house.
1938, that's a very conspicuous year for a business expansion in Germany, isn't it? It immediately rings alarm bells.
Indeed. And the research shows this expansion was only possible because Gregor Booker, the Stiftung's namesake, Aryanized house number 17 in 1937. Now, Aryanization, as you know, meant the former Jewish owner, a man named Siegfried Rosenberg, was forced under intense Nazi anti-Semitic pressure to sell his house and his business at a ridiculously low price to Booker, who was considered an Aryan buyer. Booker's personal annual income, in fact, jumped by 50% between 1937 and 1938, directly following this transaction. So the Stiftung's capital, its foundation money, originates, at least in significant part, from the founder's direct participation in the anti-Semitic plunder carried out by so-called Aryan merchants under the Nazi regime.
Wow. So even if they weren't necessarily, say, card-carrying Nazi party members themselves, they benefited directly and significantly from the regime's horrific discriminatory policies.
Precisely. The records suggest the couple were deeply Catholic, members of the Center Party, until it was dissolved in 1933. But the Nazi authorities only allowed these Aryanization bargains, these forced sales, to go through for people they deemed politically reliable, even if they weren't official NSDAP members. What's more, the Stiftung's own website today presents a deeply problematic narrative. It kind of portrays itself as a victim of Nazism because its beautiful Aryanized house was destroyed in the war in 1945. And Gregor Booker apparently claimed after the war to be an anti-Nazi because he stopped employing known Nazis in his business after 1942, despite having employed them for the 9 years prior, throughout the height of the Nazi regime. There's a clear lack of self-critical engagement with the origins of their capital and their history.
So, putting this all back into the context of the Bredegarten fight in the 80s, you have a foundation whose wealth is partly built on the forced dispossession of a Jewish businessman under the Nazis, decades later actively fighting against a public playground because there were too many Gastarbeiter Kinder children of immigrants.
It reveals a really troubling continuity, doesn't it? A pattern perhaps of exclusion, prejudice, maybe linked to protecting assets derived from questionable historical circumstances.
It really does. It adds a whole other layer to that conflict.
Yeah. The good news, however, is that despite their powerful influence and their lawsuit, the Booker Stiftung ultimately lost their case. The playground and the garden went ahead.
Okay, that's a crucial detail they lost. So despite the controversy, despite the lawsuit, the Bredegarten was finally established and built. How did it fare in its early years once it actually opened its gates to the public?
Right, so construction was finished in 1985. The main Volksgarten, the green area with the tenant plots, was complete by October 85. The playground followed in November. And humorously, perhaps, the very first dog feces were also noted almost immediately. Some things never change, huh?
Huh, yeah, sounds about right for a new park.
But jokes aside, initially, it actually functioned very well. The tenant gardens, which people leased for about 100 euros a year back then, were reportedly orderly and well-maintained. There were always people around. It wasn't considered an Angstrom, you know, place that feels unsafe or fear-inducing. And it generally seemed tidy and well-used by the community.
You have personal memories of the Bredegarten from that time, right? How did it feel to you then as someone living nearby? Was it a valuable space?
Yes, I often visited back in the 1980s and 90s. As an inner-city resident myself, without a balcony or private garden, I was incredibly grateful for the opportunity. Just to sit in the green, listen to the birdsong, watch the trees grow over the years, it really did work for quite a while, providing that much-needed urban oasis. But I guess the real question becomes, what happened? Why did it fall into disrepair? Why did something that started so well begin to decline?
That's exactly what I was wondering, too. It sounds like such a positive start, but then what went wrong? What were the forces that led to its decline?
Well, it's a story you hear about a lot with urban green spaces, unfortunately. In more recent years, it just began to decline. For one thing, the original tenants who had those little gardens, the ones who put so much work into them initially, they naturally grew older. They couldn't keep up with the physical demands of gardening anymore. But because the leases were so cheap, still around 100 euros per year, decades later, they were understandably reluctant to just give them up. So you had this kind of stagnation, plots becoming overgrown or neglected. And at the same time, the space became more of a hangout for teenagers, especially in the afternoons and evenings. Reports mention them drinking alcohol, smoking hash, listening to loud music, and unfortunately, also urinating in the gardens, which, as you can imagine, made it far less enjoyable for the original garden owners and, frankly, other residents trying to use the space peacefully.
Right. And that brings us pretty much full circle to the current situation, doesn't it? With the diggers finally coming in, clearing out those old, neglected gardens, which then led to this public outcry we saw recently. Understandable, maybe, if people didn't know the whole backstory.
Yes, exactly. There was a definite public outcry. People were quoted as being shocked to see what they perceived as just destruction of a green space. But the city, facing the reality of the situation, had to act. They contacted the remaining tenants individually to dissolve their contracts, which, according to the city, most eventually agreed to, recognizing the changing dynamics and the ongoing issues with the space.
So we've traced this space through multiple transformations, from a chaotic post-war rubble field to a planned green space with gardens and playgrounds born out of activism through its period of flourishing, then its decline, and now into this new reimagining. After exploring all that, what's your outlook on its future? Are you optimistic?
Well, if we connect all these threads, I actually think the concept behind the current redesign is probably good, despite, you know, the overly vague planning language we talked about earlier. They have preserved many of the mature trees, which is great, provides a home for birds, and I've already seen families out enjoying the new lawn area. So in these very early stages, it seems to be functioning as intended, drawing people back in. However, this raises that crucial question again, will it last?
That's the million-dollar question for so many urban projects, isn't it? You sound maybe a bit skeptical. Why, if the initial reception seems positive, what are the long-term concerns you have based on this history?
Yeah, maybe a little skeptical. My main concern is simply long-term maintenance. The city of Witten, like many municipalities these days, lacks dedicated funds to keep the area in good shape consistently over time. There's apparently a quarter caretaker who collects trash, but residents report people still litter constantly, and those owners still often don't clean up after their pets. Old habits die hard. And when I specifically asked at the first press conference about the redesign, you know, whether there were extra funds allocated for ongoing cleaning and upkeep for this newly renovated space, the answer was basically no. The existing city cleaning staff will just have to absorb it as an additional task. And as history often shows us, that often leads to neglect over time when resources are already stretched thin. Without sustained, dedicated resources, these spaces often, well, they tend to go downhill again. You know, this deep dive into just one park, the Breda Garden in Witten, it isn't just about one park. It really feels like a microcosm of the ongoing challenges we see everywhere in urban planning. It shows how these spaces are shaped by so many forces. Historical trauma, like the war and its aftermath, shifting social needs, political battles, community activism, and sometimes even these hidden agendas or uncomfortable histories that ripple through generations. Is a powerful lesson in that continuity.
It really is. It's such a profound reminder that a city's green spaces, the places we often take for granted, are rarely just simple green spaces. They're often battlegrounds, aren't they, for competing visions, competing values, and they have their own complex biographies, often with uncomfortable truths woven right into their very fabric. So what does this all mean for you listening right now? Maybe as you walk through your own city or town, or perhaps when you encounter plans for new developments, maybe you'll look a little closer. Look at the language being used to describe them, or wonder about the hidden histories of the everyday spaces around you.
Yeah, consider how past decisions, maybe decisions made decades ago, perhaps with troubling motivations you never suspect, continue to shape our present urban landscapes in ways we don't always see. And maybe ponder this question, what responsibility do our cities and our communities have, not just in creating beautiful, functional public spaces, but in truly sustaining them for future generations, especially when faced with limited resources and the inevitably changing needs of the community? It's a tough one.